And this was the one that Sue Storstein led. I mean, this took a ton of work on her time. She was a coordinator, and the monthly phone calls, we'll be talking about those, the trainings, she was the lead on all that. And so I just want to share credit with I had a great team. I had Sue Storstein and Don Reckinger, the evaluator, and Rashani Dahal, who is our research assistant. I have no relationships to disclose for this presentation. And again, it's the same HRSA grant. But we're going to talk about what we actually did with these folks in order to try to change their beliefs and their implementation, and the model that we developed based on the Johns Hopkins work that looks not only at evidence from research but evidence from practice. And this was really the heart of this grant. The fact is that if you look at our evidence, many things that we want to ask questions about, there's no articles out there. And so our evidence looks a lot like Swiss cheese. And what do you do? And you can't really work on an evidence project unless you're willing to take on some of these hard examples. And we want to talk about what makes a good champion. So this is the same list that I had in that previous session, and that is really looking at this comfort, this knowledge, time, and making sure that we address every single barrier on here. They had a picture of themselves on the Wheaties box. Okay, they were our champions, and the definition that we used is from Greenhall, and that's people who really dedicate themselves to this driving through an innovation. The innovation literature has where you go to find out the evidence about champions. And this was our magnet, and this was our poster. Come and join the stars. Search, translate, adopt, refine, and share. This was our marketing. And so people want to be stars. You can do a lot with this marketing thing. And we put out the notice. We did a recruiting. It was a local, could be local or tribal. We had both, but a governmental health department, baccalaureate prepared, that was interested both in evidence and in coaching, had access to the internet, and was somebody that we thought we could coach. That's actually N of 42. I just realized that's an error on that. And I've talked about their age, but 100% of our champions had baccalaureate, and a third of them had a master's degree. And this was primarily in our metro county, but that in our metro area. But this was who our champions were. So we did our trainings with the champions. But first, the first thing we did was a two-day training that went. They came in the night before because we had people traveling 5 hours, so we were there for like 3 days. And first we talked about what defining evidence-based practice was. We had some innovative ways because these people were not, we had not engaged them yet. Everybody got the opening brain teaser, like warmer icebreaker. You got a white sheet or a yellow sheet, and it was just random. And there were also kisses, three kinds of kisses that went around. And at the end, we were moving people into the white group and the yellow group, which was a random assignment. And they got, they still talk about that. I mean, you can talk about random, you can define random, but when you get split into the random control group because you somehow got a yellow piece of paper and had nothing to do with anything, that's a pretty good definition of random. And as far as being assigned to groups, we had them take whether they like the dark chocolate, the milk chocolate, or the almond kisses. And they had their little piles in front of them, and that's how they got assigned to groups. And that would be when you're put into groups by characteristics. And it was amazing. After 2 years, they were still talking about the kisses. You can do a lot of work with kisses, too. So I'm a strong believer in kinesthetic. You teach it, you hear it, you say it, and you move. And then you remember it. So anyway, we worked with them for 2 days on what was evidence-based practice, how to write a question, where to look. They all brought their computers. We spent time. We had to find a place where we could have 50 computers hooked up all at once. And we actually went in and started talking about evidence-based practice and practice-based evidence. And both of them can be measured for strength and for quality. We ended up talking then about champion roles, and we also did some additional training on motivational interviewing, which is what we were having the champions do with the nurses. So we said to them, defining evidence-based practice, we used Brownson's model. And it's very similar. All of evidence practice came out of medicine. Archie Cochran, who was the guy who started the Cochrane databases, was an OB. And he went off to World War II and actually was like an army surgeon, and he came back. And what had happened is there was new research out about if you administer the steroids, I don't know the exact name, you OB nurses will know, but you know, with the premature infants to develop the surfactants on the lungs, he came back and he knew that there were these steroids that could be administered to help babies to develop the lung capacity when they were premature, and was shocked to see so many physicians that he worked with not knowing this information. And he actually was motivated to start figuring out a way where physicians could have access to the most current data, and that was the origin of evidence-based medicine. And it's always been the research, this was a medical definition, the research, the professional expertise, as well as the patient preferences. So now nursing basically took the medical definition of evidence-based practice and used that. Client preference, professional expertise, what's in the research. Dr. Brownson uses the evidence that's available, added health data, because in population health, in public health, we have data. This is not in the medicine or the nursing definition of evidence-based practice, public health expertise, and he also broadened it from the family or patient, broader into the community and the stakeholders. And so this is a really different model, because we do have data in public health, population data, and we had discussions with our champions. Is it about if you're saving money, is that the evidence? Is it cost effectiveness? Is it that you have better health outcomes? What if you're having better health outcomes but it costs more money? I mean, those things are going to come up if you're trying to work with this kind of issue. And we just said that the evidence is the available body of facts on whether a proposition is true or valid, and it's not necessarily just out of research. You can see it doesn't say best research available. It says best evidence available. So where do you find the evidence? And we spend a lot of time, this is, we help people go into these. We were shocked how many people don't know the Guide to Community Preventive Services, which is population health strategies that have recommendations, whether they're, you know, sufficient recommendation or sufficient evidence or insufficient evidence. We like the Canadian model. That was one we always taught. We took them to the Cochrane. We took them to the Campbell. They were delighted to find out that all the Cochrane collaborations now have a plain language summary. When's the last time you were in one of the Cochranes? Isn't it great to have a plain language summary? Not that you don't want to read the detailed ones, but even nurses just sometimes need the plain language. We taught them how to use Google Scholar, and we worked out an arrangement with the Minnesota Department of Health so that we have a sheet with about 20, probably 30 now, resources. This is all available at www.publichealthnurses.org. Everything that you have up there, all these tools, all these resources, the instruments, so it's all publicly available. I brought magnets that I will share with you. So we certainly did go after the evidence that was out there. If you can find evidence, that's always best. The problem is there's just not enough evidence. And so this is a model. It comes out of the Johns Hopkins Evidence-Based Practice Model and Guidelines. And their pyramid actually stands up like a pyramid, but ours turned on its side. And you can see there's three levels. And the first three are what we would traditionally think about as evidence. They're out of the research. They're out of the articles that we read. Level 4 and level 5, that's our practice-based evidence. So we took this model and we broke it up. Oh, my blue moved, sorry. But the evidence that we get to support our practice comes from public health nursing, from public health, from nursing. It comes from sometimes psychology. It comes from organizational development. We are an interdisciplinary discipline, public health and nursing together, and so we draw on many sources. But the research that we used, we worked with random control trials and meta-analysis, the meta-synthesis, as well as the quasi-experimental. And so we, coming up, there's some slides of how did we help the champions get comfortable. Remember from the analysis that they actually felt more comfortable doing critical analysis of meta-analysis and random control trials. But we also have, especially in public health and public health nursing, evidence from practice. If you look at the expert consensus panels, clinical guidelines, a lot of stuff that comes out of CDC, a lot of stuff, a lot of guidance, resources, guidelines come out of expert consensus panels and clinical practice guidelines, but they're not really, quote, random controlled trials. So what we really tried to teach them is that evidence can come from everywhere, including your own case studies, including your own community assessment, including what you know, but it has to be evaluated. And so, broken my own rule and having too many words, but this is on the website. This is this cheat sheet. Everybody got this cheat sheet laminated because people don't throw away laminated things. They keep them. So anyway, at the top is the level, which is those levels 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whether it's a random control trial. They got so excited to find the random control trials. They just did. You know, you can't help it. It's just easiest if you can find a random control trial. And if you can find a meta-analysis of random control trials, when they figured out what that was, they just wondered why more professors didn't do more of those. They thought that that's what we should be doing for practice. So there's levels 1, 2, and 3, and then 4 and 5 were the practice. But the fact is, it's not enough just to look at the strength of evidence. The Wakefield article that linked autism and MMR is a clear example that you also have to look at quality. So we looked and we worked with high, good, or major flaws, and we taught them how to look at that. It was easiest to teach them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It was harder to teach them about quality of evidence. But if you're going to have people out there reading articles, you have to take this on. We addressed several issues. I actually purchased this cartoon. One of it is that our evidence is not clear. Smoking or non-smoking, hormone therapy or non-hormone therapy section. What do you do when the evidence doesn't agree? I mean, that was a huge thing that we had to talk to with our champions and help them walk through. And we talked about the fact, this is the actual Wakefield article. If you go to Lancet, such an esteemed journal. Every single page of the Wakefield article in Lancet looks like this, with a big red retracted on it. And so it was a personal interest because Dr. Wakefield had traveled to Minnesota during that time when it was being retracted. We have a significant Somalian population, the second largest in the United States, in fact, and the concern about the levels of autism in that new population group. And Dr. Wakefield came and supported their efforts that it was the immunizations that were related to the autism, even though he's lost his license, I believe, now. So anyway, I feel terrible that anything like that would happen to anyone, but it was timely for the project. I mean, it was, because it was like, here is a random control trial that had major flaws. And they said, if only they would have looked at that article and looked at the research, little evidence with insufficient sample size, with conclusions cannot be drawn, they wouldn't be in this mess. So it's like, this mattered. They understood that. So the champions then had this initial training, and then they had monthly trainings, but we started out right away because we had many places to go. We went and trained every health department that had a champion. That was the only way we could figure out how to do this. So what we really went out with, we had to make it very concrete and applicable, because these were very busy people. Just being told that is a mandatory training in the health department was enough to send some people, you know. But I have WIC clinic, but I have this immunization clinic, but I have this. And I'm saying, well, you know, we'll come again. If we have to work around WIC clinic, we'll work around WIC clinic. We want everybody there, the dietitians, the nutritionists, the social workers, the nurses. So we talked about taking practice questions, adding the evidence so that what really happened is it was applied. And they got that. They got that right away. But we really wanted them to think that it was part of what they did every single day. And this was harder to convince them. But if you can convince them of this, then they started using their champions. So these were some of their practice questions. We taught them to write practice questions. When you go to frontline staff, can we reuse masks for DOT visits? Okay, we ended up looking at FEMA, at CDC, at OSHA. I think we looked at 5 sites. We helped them research this one to come up with a guideline. Of course, there was no agreement on whether you can reuse masks for DOT visits. Though it's pretty clear the evidence says no. What type of incentives work best to motivate parents to change behavior? What's the best practice for effective meetings? A lot of questions about that one. They hate going to meetings where they don't think anything has changed. how to reduce pregnancy, strategies for what immunization noncompliance, parents that don't want to get their shots, interventions to increase the duration of breastfeeding by women who get home visits, culturally diverse families to stop bed sharing. We have a large, you know, back to sleep campaign, and part of it is to have people not do bed sharing. And what we really found out with this one is that the physicians in the community were saying it was okay, and the public health nurses who have, you know, working with WIC, that guideline would be that you can't do bed sharing. So what the nurses were caught in the middle. And these are the kinds of things when you why are you asking that question? It was interesting because it's a different solution than finding the evidence. The evidence is clear about bed sharing. It's dangerous to babies. What we needed was the evidence of how to work with the community when the physicians and the health departments are putting out different kinds of information. And we had them, what do you work with that's evidence-based? And right away, of course, we have our immunizations. We work the olds, you know, to look at the evidence. These were two that we studied. But we really, we asked the nurses and other staff about when is there sufficient evidence to change the way that they practice? And it was a curious question. They said no one had ever asked them that before. And how much do you have to have before you change? Because it's always most comfortable to keep doing the same thing. And we said, what do you do? How do you know what to do? Well, it's what I learned when I was in school. It's what I learned when I was a new nurse. It's how I got oriented. How long have you been working? 22 years. I mean, you'd have these really interesting conversations, and they'd kind of look at me and go, oh, yeah, you know, things have changed. And so we talked a lot about back to sleep and how that was such an evidence-based strategy that has now unintended consequences, ranging from torticollis, because we have parents that will never put their baby on their tummies ever, not for play. And so their heads are not developing, their necks are not developing. Every solution, because it's a wicked problem, every solution creates a new problem. So this says back to sleep and tummy to play. The evidence shows that you don't have to aspirate when you do an immunization. I'm sorry, the evidence shows you don't have to aspirate when you do immunization. I've had people say, you know, I'll die before I quit aspirating. One time in the 14,000 immunizations I gave, there was blood. I thought, okay. I had another nurse say, you know, once I did hit a vein and I knew it right away, I didn't have to aspirate. And so she stood up. But, I mean, it's these kinds of things, and you don't think that's big, but it has a lot to do with change. And I don't know how many of you still aspirate if you do immunizations. Our state health department, this is the Denver, and many of us did Denver's. How many of you have ever done a Denver? Okay. In Minnesota, education, human services, and our health department came together and said that is no longer a best practice and you can't use it. Go on our website. For all the reasons, they did a thorough study as far as cultural sensitivity. It was normed on 100 white kids in Denver. There's many, many reasons that they decided that we should not use the Denver. Well, I just use it to teach. I don't really use it, you know. So trying to change this behavior, you could just do a whole research study on how to get people to quit using the Denver. And it's involving CTC, our EPSDT trainings and screenings, and we are required to use ages and stages. And, you know, like I let my academic colleagues know that they no longer were supposed to be teaching the Denver. That went over like a lead balloon. I was like, well, it's in our curriculum. We've taught the Denver for, it was just remarkable when you start looking at actually changing practice. And then these new guidelines that have come out from the American Pediatric Association about how it doesn't really matter if you give fruit before cereal or vegetable before fruits. It's not going to make babies get a sweet tooth. You don't have, you know, oh, we still do a lot of teaching. Rice first, single cereal. Then the vegetables, no salt, no sugar, no fruit until those vegetables, or they'll never eat those vegetables. You know, the evidence support, none of that. When I was a young public health nurse, I wrote Feeding Your Baby with Love, and it had all that good guidance in it. Well, it turns out unless you've got a kid from a really allergic family, that doesn't hold. So if you go on the American Pediatric, APA website, you can see their suggested infant feeding schedules and their new recommendations. This was like hearsay when I went out to those agencies. But if you didn't take them on where they really felt it, they weren't going to talk about it. Now, they didn't all change. Some of them will do it till they die. I follow Rogers' diffusion of innovation. You work with the early adopters. They'll bring in that middle, that large majority. Those laggards, they can outlast you. They can always outlast you, so I give up. And then they had an exercise. No, they are going to outlast me. Unless someone fires them, I'm serious. Those laggards where people spend a lot of time on, you're not going to change that tail.
They will die.
Yes, they will eventually die. But they, and I'm all for changing as much, but with limited resources, you got to know your target group. And we are after those early adopters, not the innovators, because innovators are always the wild children. And people go, I'm not like that. But if you can get the early adopters on that model, I digress. My apologies. I love that model. Okay. We also asked them, they had an exercise where they talked about the kinds of things that they did that were evidence-based. And when we asked staff that worked in everything from emergency preparedness to TB, these were the kinds of things that they said, this is what we do. Interesting, the brain development came up, vitamin D, the depression screening, folic acid, Maslow's hierarchy. I thought how interesting that they would cite that as the evidence for their practice. So one of the things that we did, I'm interested in how much people think they're actually evidence-based. Because some of the nurses said, you know, I work in disease prevention and control, and most of my practice is evidence-based. And others said, you know, I work in community health promotion with adolescent smoking, and I don't think there's any real evidence out there at all because it's not been long enough. You know, you've got to have long-term kinds of interventions. So we did a couple webinars, national webinars that I'll talk about, but we did ask that group. There was almost 800 people on, but only 263 came on, and we asked them, these were practicing folks, to estimate the percentage of their current practice that was based on evidence. And we were pretty shocked, actually, to see the numbers. These are numbers, not percentages, of people that thought that, like, 80% to 100%, 40 people said that all of their practice was evidence-based. And so you can see this layout. So that was an assumption that we thought nurses would say they were not evidence-based. And when they really sat down and wrote down, we had to write what they did, the little exercise was what they did and what was their evidence. And sometimes they put down MDH training, Minnesota Department of Health training. I'd say, sorry, what was it that you were taught? Oh, well, this is what we were taught. And it got a lot of conversations going on. And then the nurses started talking about if they did this the same or different. Also at the end, we brought up the champions help to teach. And we said, this is your champion. And this is why we have champions here. Because really what we can do together is very different than what we can do alone. So we made a big deal of their champions, that their champions had direct access to this team, that we could come back if they wanted. We gave them some authority, which I think is very important. The other thing we did with our champion, they're called the updaters, and every month we had a one-hour conference call at two different times because we had champions that worked in WIC. Not to pick on WIC, but that was one of our very set times for clinics. That both Sue and Roshani worked very hard with. The champions would submit articles, and then they would critique the articles. And when I say that, we had a book, and it's on our website. So you can see there's 8 pages of quality of evidence, whether high, moderate, low quality, flawed. What would that look like if you were a level 3, or what would that look like if you were a level 1? A ton of work that went into the development of this. But they would send us articles like this: measles outbreak in highly vaccinated population. So they're interested in why people were getting the measles. And so they actually went in during the hour-long conference calls and looked, using those guidelines, what would you look for in an article? This is how you learn to critique an article. You go into an article and you do this. And then we posted these on our website. And so they decided this was the quality of evidence was B, and this was Y, that it mentions but did not describe the limitations thoroughly, it lacks generalizability, and it's only a very brief application to practice. So it's a level 3, again, methods, results, this is what you look at, this is how you use this guide, and so they love this article review. And we got better at it too. It was a little hard to figure out how to teach this, but this they wanted more of this, they wanted more of this, they wanted more of this. And they got more comfortable with the language. And then, this is the website that we developed, www.publichealthnurses.org. And again, because this project came out of failure for many years to be able to figure out how to get nurses to use more evidence, I truly respect the work of public health nurses and what they do and how hard they work. So it was my frustration and a little bit of theirs, but mostly mine and Sue's. But if you look at the evidence database, this is stock. Oh, Sue, she would have my head. This is not loaded. This is something. Anyway, it's full of articles that have been pre-rated. Okay, we taught them about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and now they got that. So you can go into this database, and you can pick the topic, family home visiting. We've got we've got all of the interventions from the intervention wheels and 8 additional topics. And it's not all the evidence in the world. When we went into childhood obesity, we came up with 300 articles we had to look at. What you'll find in this database are the 40 best, having 2 readers who are experts in that area. So the evidence base, don't ever tell Sue I forgot that word. But anyway, the database is loaded with these articles, and it's continually updated on different topics. We've got immunization non-compliance, and again, it would be we wanted to have only 30, but obesity had so many articles. The 20 best, and you can say, give me all the number ones, give me all the number fives. And so there's the database. There's also some of these are password protected. Under training would be the webinars that we did, all the other pieces that we did, and then I'll talk more about resources in the next one. The other thing, though, we did with the champions is we wanted them to understand that they were champions and that these are the things that they would do. And we went to the literature for what was a champion. And it's really about education and sharing information and mentoring and role modeling. But we also told them that they knew their organization best and that they had to develop the role that fit culturally within that organization so that they would be successful. And this is a model we used, and I'm just showing it because across the top, opinion leader, facilitator, champion, linking agent, change agent. We did have a theory. This is our theory from Thompson, Estabrooks, and Digner. But we changed it to look more like this. Okay, this is what the professors look like. This is what we look at because we need the theory, right? Because we are theory-based. So this is what we used, and this is what we took to them. And they got this right away. It's the same thing. It's the model, only there's this continuum, and you can move up the continuum and down the continuum. You either actually do the search for the people in your agency, or you can teach the people in your agency how to do that search. You can sit with them in their articles, or you can just email them your results. And that's about knowing your agency and the time you have and the interest you have. We had champions that developed journal clubs. We had champions that did every staff meeting, they would do an analysis together. We had people that were movers and shakers. There was a big whiteboard, what is your evidence question today? And people would write questions. There was some excitement to this. And so that's why we saw the changes that we saw. It was very clear there was no right or wrong role, that we had to consider what agency they were in. If they're in an agency with 4 people up in northwestern Minnesota, they had the same capacity. It turned out they just didn't have some of the same resources. There were many external challenges. We talked about, this is the way it's done here, and that's what accreditation is all about, and that can be changed, and that was changed, and that had a lot to do with their own creative passion. Public health nurses have a lot of passion. You got to make sure it's directed in the right place. I've never did a training with a group of public health nurses, and I've done hundreds of them, where the word passion and social justice doesn't come up. It took me a long time to realize that passion has to be guided, because it can be ignited if it's not directed. So champions, what really makes a champion is this enthusiasm and their visionary qualities. And we shared this, that they were transformational. You know, when someone looks at you seriously and says, you are a transformational leader, they believed us. They believed us, and we said, we will be behind you all the way. Besides the monthly phone calls, constant flow of emails and messages, we had, when they had trouble with searches, we did searches for them. We did everything we could to move them up on that independent scale. And I'll end this session with this quote, that champions adopt programs, ideas, or project as their own and relentlessly promote them. So we told them to relentlessly steal and share relentlessly. We taught them to share relentlessly. Personal ownership of an idea or project is a central feature of this role. So now you've seen the evidence. We had statistical changes on both the beliefs and the implementation, and you've seen a quick snapshot of what we did with the champions. So surely now there will be questions. Well, it came out of the need. Thank you very much for that. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, the purpose that this project was funded through under HRSA is no longer there. HRSA has changed. So I was going to apply for a continuation grant because I have 30 health departments, not just from Minnesota, but North Dakota has many of our, along the North Dakota border with Minnesota, those counties tend to share almost similar cities. They're just cities that overlap. And so the North Dakotans wanted and did attend some of our trainings, even though it was from Minnesotans. But anyway, North Dakota really wanted to partner with us, so we are looking for ways to sustain it. Because now that other majority is ready to come in. It was like a champion. Why would I want a champion? And they had plenty of ideas about the additional kinds of training. We have a core of champions now to build on. That's the great thing. And not all of them were successful. I don't want to make this look like they were all successful, but that core group that we have, man, they are ready to go. And they're saying, what are we going to do now? And so what's the next thing? And what's the advanced thing? And how are we going to do this? And so, you know, we're looking at different models. So thank you. Thank you for that encouragement. Well, thanks. Kathy Baldwin probably is in the same place because it is one of the issues is that we deal with populations rather than patients, and so we've got people like Michelle Issel and Betty Beckmeyer trying to help us make that giant leap, but that's sometimes where I get caught. So, but it has been rewarding to feel like when I could get those staff nurses to generate questions that they thought were useful, I thought this was the key that I've been looking at for a long time. Charlotte. Yes. That was key, and that was, you know, a requirement for the champion. They had that access. And all of this is available. Everything, like I said, is on our website, and we've got both process training instruments. We'd be glad to share them with anybody interested in this. Marion. Oh, what a hard question. Of course I do, but I don't know that. Because we had our discussion this morning about wicked problems. Are you familiar with the wicked Wicked versus tame problems. I mean, if you haven't seen that model, it comes out of urban planning, and it's my leadership model that I work with my students. So we can talk about that separately. Yes, I have several leadership models, and would be glad to talk with you later about that. Well, part of it is that I believe that everything we do, whether it's a grant or working with the client, is relationship-based in public health nursing. And this is built on 30 years of relationships with local health departments, with people across the nation. This is how you get things done. And the new model in healthcare management is about relationship-based interventions. It's recognized that whether you're running a hospital or an HMO, that the hierarchical military model doesn't work. Just looked at a new book for a course, Relationship-Based Healthcare Management. Go to the website, Plexus, which is all about complexity. We can no longer keep thinking that we can just work in our little area and make a difference. So, of course, with this grant, it was like, well, is it for nurses? Well, the funding's from the Division of Nursing, and this grant is for everyone on the team that works in public health, because you don't work alone in a health department any more than you work alone in a hospital floor. So, it's about collaboration, and I encourage you to look at the framework of what is a wicked problem. Difficult to define, no care closure. You do a solution, you come up with a bigger problem. You have to be able to foresee some of these things. There's 8 criteria, and that things like poverty or social determinants of health are wicked problems. It doesn't mean they're evil. It's wicked versus tame. And if you like any kind of, if you're thinking that about systems and complexity and how, if you punch a system here, it says ouch over here, and how if we're ever going to take on the health determinants in any way in this country, we're going to have to go cross-organization. And so there's a strategy. If it's shared understanding, shared meaning, and it's very important. So I've really digressed now, but I'd be glad to talk to you later. Gotcha. Other questions about the presentation? Yes. Okay, it would be a longer time, and that would be ideal. And I've looked to some of my colleagues within our research. I work at the University of Minnesota that might be interested in doing some of that. I'm interested in the more translational, but definitely. It would have to be long term. It takes a long time, but definitely that would be the next thing, is to look at outcomes. I hope they just don't decide to look at agencies with champions and not champions and use that as a measure, because I don't think that's enough. But ultimately, this would have to go to outcomes. And it may be well that the relationship might even change. One of the areas that we have on the website is relationship-based practice. I mean, that's a key piece that public health nurses do. I was so interested that the nurses shared research with clients. I did not expect that one. That was that, because this model came, the instrument came from acute care. So some of these things I thought, we're not going to have those, but that was one that we did. So we had a question from that gentleman.
Yes.
Well, if I'm going to just flash back, I hope this doesn't happen on the recording. It probably will. But there's, where did the guidelines go? There's one of these for qualitative. There's qualitative and quantitative. Here. There's 8 of these. And so they went into some depth. If you look at these about looking at the quality grids and the strength grids, both quantitative and qualitative, much of what we have is case studies and expert opinions. And so how do you figure out the level of quality for articles that are written by experts? Well, we made this one up, and sometimes you do that, but we had them Google these people. Because if you've written anything, go see what else they've written. That would be another way if there's people that are... Because you can have an article and you have never seen this name before and you don't know. Because the questions are about what is the expertise of the expert opinion writer. So you have to figure out who is this person who's writing this article. So I encourage you to go to the website, and then all of these are available for both quantitative and qualitative. You know, with there, especially among the nurses, there's a bias that you cannot use random controlled trials with many of the interventions that we do, that it's not ethical, that you need community-based participatory research. There's all those kinds of issues, which were separate issues. But.